The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, show number, episode number 456 for Sunday, June 30th, 2013. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. As we said, episode number 456. What you can do is you can go back and listen to episode 1, 2, 3. So you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 right in a row. And that way you can hear two episodes of the show where we answer your questions, share your tips. Next week, we'll share cool stuff found here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Mr. F. Braun, how are you today?
Great. Oh, exhausted, man. I've been just all over the place the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, you went to a bunch of shows.
Four different shows. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, four different shows.
That's awesome. You want to tell us which shows those were? I know we're saving some of the stuff you saw for the Cool Stuff Found show next week, but go ahead and tell us.
Yeah. Well, the first... I think it's by Propel Media. It's called Holiday Gift Guide. So it's, but there's technology companies there. And yep. Actually, I think all the shows I went to, I actually scored at least one gimme, which is what it's all about. But now I'll be getting some hands-on experience with some new devices here. So yeah, the first was called Holiday Gift Guide and saw some neat things there. Then the next was Pepcom, Digital Experience.
Yep.
And then the third was Gadget Engadget Live, which is also, well, they have a special hour where just media can interact with the vendors. And then they let in the riffraff or regular people. Yeah, they did better this time. Last time they had like a queuing nightmare in that there were people, like if you showed up early to get in early, it took them like 45 minutes to process you.
Oh, that's bad.
So guys, and people used, what is it, Eventbrite or something.
Oh, that's
and
great.
It's like, yeah. It's like, I'm already registered. Just scan my barcode and let me in.
Yeah.
They did better this year, though. They were good. Actually out on the sidewalk registering people. And then the last event was CE Week, which is kind of like a mini CES. Well, very mini. It only occupied one building, but
right.
It's done by CEA, which I guess is the same people that do CES.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Huh. Yeah, that's enough Manhattan for now.
Yeah, that's good, though. I mean, that's the kind of thing that and were they all in the same night or were they kind of back to back days?
One was in the middle of the day and then. Well, the first one was in the middle of the day. The second one was in the evening. I prefer those, actually. So they started like 6 at night. So,
yeah.
The third one was in the evening. And then the fourth one was pretty much an all-day, 2-day, all-day affair. So,
okay. That's cool. Huh. I should go to those. I mean, it's not that far. I'd get a hotel in New York and just like treat it like one, you know, trade show trip. That'd be a good thing.
Yeah. Take the train, man.
Yeah, for me, taking the train, if I have to be in Midtown, taking the train almost takes the same amount of time as the plane because, you know, with security. And then once you get to the airports in New York, you know, it's easily an hour to get to Midtown, whereas the train just takes me there. The other way to do it is to take the plane from you're huffing and puffing over there. Everything all right? You're are you just sipping your warm morning beverage there?
Yes.
Got it. But there's a plane that leaves out of Lebanon, New Hampshire, that flies to Westchester, and then it's a little 8-seater plane, and then the limo meets you in Westchester and takes you to Penn Station, and the same thing happens on the reverse trip. But so, you know, lots of options.
Right. All right. So, Dave, I was having a big problem last week.
You were.
I thought I'd dive in and just tell you what I went through here, and this is somewhat of a surprise to you. So. If you recall, I was having an issue with packet loss, and the impact was not evident to anybody except me, really.
As far as the Skype connection went, that's right.
Right. So what was happening is I was basically not able to hear Dave very well because I was getting packet loss. And how do you know about that? Well, there's this window in Skype that'll tell you send and receive packet loss. And we were getting a level of like 20%, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Oddly, I was getting no packet loss from you. So it was, you know, so the listeners didn't have to suffer other than hearing us talk about it, which they have to suffer again.
So
there's a lesson here. Yeah.
So then I'm like, all right, you know, this is really bugging me, man. I got to figure out what's up here. So one of the first things I did is, you know, I restarted my Mini. And after I restarted it, it got a 169 IP address. And I'm like, all right, that's bad.
For those of you that don't know, IP, when your computer is set to automatically get an IP address from your router, if it can't get an IP address from your router, it assigns itself an IP in the 169.254 range. So if you see that, as John did, that's, you know, indicative of some sort of problem. So
now when you're in that state, you could, you should be able to communicate with any other machines that also get a 169 address. So it doesn't
that's
mean
the
that,
idea. That's right.
It doesn't mean that you can't communicate, but it means something's wrong with the DHCP mechanism. So I'm like, all right, well, let's start figuring this out. So I'm like, you know what? So the way I'm set up right now is I have my time capsule, which is my router, and then a switch, a gigabit switch. And so everything was plugged into that. And then that's plugged into the time capsule. I'm like, well, you know, let me try the first thing here. I'm like, let me take my computer and plug it not into the switch, but into the router directly. And lo and behold, I got an IP address. I'm like, okay, well, there's a problem on that part of the network.
Yep.
And then I looked and I saw the DOS blinking lights were blinking. I'm like, okay, well, that's normal, but it was showing where there was network activity. Most switches do some level of this. And I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. Then I fired up Wireshark just to see what was going on here. Wireshark is a packet monitor, and it can show you the traffic that's flying around on your network. And so I fired it up, and I was seeing just a flood of UDP coming from some device. All these UDP packets.
Now, and
that makes sense now because DHCP also operates using UDP. So as far as I know. So
had you power cycled traffic. Had you power cycled the switch at all during this process?
Yes.
You had. Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah, I think I power cycled everything just to eliminate it as a problem.
Yeah,
I thought at first it was the switch. I actually have another one and I replaced it, but that wasn't it. Then I'm like, okay, well, what do I have plugged into the switch here? And I didn't look at the packets too closely here, but I figured, you know, it was quick enough for me to just, well, let me just yank devices and, you know, and see the impact.
Oh,
and I was also running test calls.
That's a great way to do it. Yeah.
And as it turns out, apparently my transporter was in some wacky state. And then as soon as I pulled it, packet loss went down to single digits.
Yep.
So I don't know what was going on. It was in a weird state because I was getting notifications. It was trying to keep updating this one document and it just kept doing it. Even though it was updated, it's like, I'm going to update it again. I'm going to update it again. So something was in some weird state. But
And I was getting the same notifications for the same document because it was in our shared Mac Geek Gab folder on our transporters, which is interesting. I don't know what it means, but interesting. So
the other thing I did to help a little bit is I actually shortened my cable run.
Okay, let's back up a second with the transporter. Right. So to diagnose it, you unplugged it from your switch. But to solve it, did you just power cycle the transporter and that solved the problem?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Because I've seen that.
And
I've
the computer. So either it or the software was doing something that it should be doing, but it was causing a flood of traffic on my switch.
Yep.
And so that's why I was getting both packet loss and a DHCP failure.
I've had this problem with one of the iMacs in the house would cause this and I would have to restart the machine and then it was exactly the same symptoms. You know, I couldn't get traffic across the network or, you know, IP addresses wouldn't come and I just had to, you know, restart the machine and then everything was fine. And then I've also had this problem with my Sonos units. Now with the Sonos units, it's a little bit different because I was creating a loop in the network. Because the Sonos units communicate both wirelessly and wired. And if you have them plugged in, they're actually supposed to use a protocol called STP, spanning tree protocol, to decide whether or not to send data across one link or the other so that they don't create a loop. But with power line connectors in there, the power, some of the power line stuff does not pass these STP packets. So it didn't work. A little extra geeky for your Sunday morning or for my Sunday morning. But I always thought with my iMac, when I had this problem, that in some way I was creating a loop or had, you know, my network is kind of sprawling. So I've got switches in various spots. It's not all just into one thing. I've got a switch in the office, and then that is bridged to a switch in the house, which is then bridged to another switch in the house. So, you know, switches are, we call them semi-intelligent devices. Certainly the ones you and I run, John, or you know, they're not, I don't run any managed switches, which would be like fully intelligent, but you know, they get confused sometimes and start echoing packets in the wrong direction. And sometimes just power cycling the switch can solve it. But for you, you had to power cycle the devices. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I did was I did shorten my cable run a bit, even though my voltages looked fine. They look a little better now. So I actually eliminated a redundant run of cable. I chopped about 6 feet out of my run from the street to the cable modem. And that helped a little bit. Actually, I saw the transmit power level. It went from like 48 dBmV down to like 46.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But my downstream is still variable. I still think it's a optimum online problem. But my upstream, oddly enough, when I benchmarked my upstream, I don't know when they did this, but all of a sudden now I'm getting, instead of 2 megabits, I'm getting 4 megabits upstream.
Okay. All right. So I actually replaced my cable modem this week, John. I had totally forgotten about this, but I had a weird thing going on. You know, I run this DDWRT firmware on my router, and it had been working fine, and they release updates pretty regularly. And so I put an update on, and after I did this, my router wouldn't get an IP address from the cable modem until I unplugged and replugged the Ethernet cable. And if I rolled back to the old version of the software, the problem didn't happen. So I started, and this was like this has been going on for about 3 months. And so I wrote the author of the software and said, hey, you know, there's some bug you introduced. And he was like, dude, it's not a bug. I'm like, well, but here's the, you know, here's the regression test. I go back. It's not there. I move forward. It is pretty confident that it's a bug. He's like, bug with your cable modem, not bug with software. Like, okay. He's German, you know, and this is why this broken English kind of thing going on. And so I went round and round with him, and I kept asking other people on the forums, you know, anybody else seeing this? Nobody chimed in. Finally, I was like, okay, fine. So I went down and I got a new cable modem, totally solved the problem. The guy was right. It was some weird bug in my cable modem that for whatever was happening in these newer versions of the software made this thing so that it couldn't get an IP address on restart. So, but it is good to replace your cable modem about once a year. I find maybe once every 2 years, for two reasons. A, they are very susceptible to damage from electrical surges, lightning, et cetera, et cetera. But also, for me, a lot of times you'll have your provider will be providing you with more speed than you originally got because things just kind of get upgraded. Along the lines, I've certainly seen that with Comcast here, but if you don't have a modem that supports the latest stuff, then you aren't going to get the new speeds. So that's why I try to replace mine about once a year. I probably do it about once every 2 years, but it pays off. So there you go. More advice.
Yeah. I should do that too.
Yeah.
Get a DOCSIS 3 or something.
That's what I'm on now is a DOCSIS 3. Yeah. Yeah, that might actually solve some of your problem. When was the last time you replaced your cable modem?
3 years ago, and they gave me the same one. It's this cheap little Scientific Atlanta thing. Tiny little thing.
Yeah, you should get a DOCSIS 3 from them. And here's a piece of advice, and I don't know if it's necessary anymore, but a couple of years ago when Comcast was first rolling out DOCSIS 3, I knew I wanted a DOCSIS 3 modem, and so I ordered the, like, fastest speed tier I could get from them. And I don't know if they gave me a week for free with it or whatever, but I just got it for a week. I tested it. It was amazing having, you know, 100 megabit per second downstream or whatever, and 50 megabit per second upstream. It was something ridiculous. And then I just called them up and said, yeah, I want to ratchet back to, you know, whatever the 20 and 4, whatever the speed tier was. And they're like, okay, fine. And so they ratcheted me back, but they never took the faster modem back. So that actually bought me some time for a little bit. But the DOCSIS 3 stuff, it's cool because it bonds on more than one channel is how that works, John. And you can see it. What's that?
Yes, potentially you can get way more speed.
Yeah, well, when I pull up my cable modem status page, it shows that I have like 8 downstream channels and I think 2 upstream channels bonded. So, and that's how they accomplish the faster speeds. So,
all right.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I hopefully, do you rent your modem from Optimum Online or do you own it, John?
It's included in the price of the cable package.
So they're responsible for it.
Yeah. I think the thing is that the last time I had an issue, the only thing is that they're reluctant to actually ship you a new one. But if I go to their office in Norwalk, then
yep.
That's what I did last time. Just swapped it out.
Yep. Well, I think that would be a good first step to see if that is enough to solve your packet loss issues. And if not, then make them come out to the house. They'll fix it for you.
Because somewhere there's a bit bucket that's overflowing with all these lost packets.
I know. You're trying to, I'm trying to send them to you and they're just not making it, man. It's not good. All right. Let's go to, let's answer some questions, shall we, John? Now that we're fully warmed up here. So Jürgen writes, inspired by you, guys, I signed up for CrashPlan. I've been backing up to the cloud for a while now, and I like the unintrusive way it works in the background. Since Time Machine was giving me trouble with my backups, I was thinking of letting my local backups also be done by CrashPlan. This raises the question, which folders should I back up? My /users folder, which contains all of the user data, is a no-brainer. He says, I also added applications because it saves me all the trouble of downloading and reinstalling my apps again. So my thought is to replace Time Machine. In the event I have to completely reinstall a computer, I would then simply install the OS from a USB stick and then restore from the CrashPlan backup. Are there any additional folders you guys would recommend? So this is interesting. Interesting to rely solely on CrashPlan. And it's smart if you're going to do that. It's smart to let CrashPlan also back up locally, which means either just backing up to a folder on a hard drive connected to your Mac, which CrashPlan will do, and it will actually do for free. You do not need to sign up for their service to do this, or you can back up to a hard drive connected to another Mac, either local in your network or out on the internet, and that's also free. The only thing you pay for with CrashPlan is backing up to their cloud. And when you do that, you do get some additional features like backup sets and things like that that you can also use locally that are locked out if you don't have a paying subscription and obviously support. But so what folders to back up? Making sure you're getting your whole home folder, which you are if you're backing up all of users. And backing up all of users gives you the added benefit of backing up any users that are set up on your Mac. So that's good. The /library folder might potentially have some interesting stuff, but you might get more than you need there. One thing, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts, John, but I will say one thing to make sure of that I make sure of is with my Macs. I try to make sure I'm not duplicating data in my backups, and on all of my Macs, I have several things that are duplicated. Number one is my mail, right? So that's in home library mail. And I only let that get backed up by one of my Macs. I don't need 4 Macs backing up that same mail folder. So that saves a ton, especially on my MacBook Air, which is mobile and all that. So I don't back up mail from there. Dropbox, SugarSync, the connected data folders, if you're a transporter user, and I can't wait until version 2 of their software comes out because it's going to make it much easier to manage this stuff. But you know, those kind of cloud sync services, think about how you're backing them up, because you really only need to get them from one place. I mean, it could be argued that you could say, well, I don't need them from any place because they're in the cloud. Yeah, I like to have at least one copy of my Dropbox data on CrashPlan, but I don't need 4. So So think about that, because you can go through and deselect folders as well. Or you can set up file exclusions and have it filter folders based on certain names. So any other folders that you would either certainly include or potentially exclude, John?
Actually, I was going to say that the applications folder, if you are going to back that up, then because I went through this recently, it probably is not going to have, for some applications, everything you need, in that you can just drag the application from the backup to a new machine and it's going to work.
Right. But he's also getting his home, his entire home folder, which has the application support folders in it.
Right. I think the only other one you'd want is that you may want to get the higher level or the system version of these.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, and that lives in the library folder, but you could just go and get /library/application support and get that from there. Yeah, very few apps will leave stuff out there, but some do, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be nice if the stuff in the applications folder always would run on its own without any supporting files, but in some cases it does not. Other than that, I mean, yeah, the user folder, or, you know, like in my case, I'm looking at it now. I guess the only thing you may want to exclude in that, you know, like downloads, probably don't need those.
That's another good one to exclude. I do. I exclude that one from mine. Good catch. Yep.
Because that's stuff you can download again. So unless it's a really huge one. And then, yeah, I guess depending on how important this stuff is, you know, I see, you know, there's movies, music, pictures, stuff like that. So that's a
Yeah. You know what? While we're talking about this, when you mentioned downloads, it hit me that I should just launch CrashPlant on this machine and see what I have excluded, because that will help tell us. But I know I'm excluding mail, Dropbox, downloads is definitely one of them. I exclude, and this is me. I exclude the folders that have my virtual machines in them for Parallels and VMware and that sort of thing. Because I don't have data. I use those more as test environments, I'll say, as opposed to, storing actual data out there. If I were storing actual data, then I would back those up for sure. But they're just big files. Yeah, the connected data stuff is interesting, because there's a connected data folder. This actually, Pete and I have been running into this. In your home folder, if you have a transporter, there's a connected data folder on the root of your home folder. So at the top level, I should say, of your home folder. And that is actually a pointer to the data that lives on your transporter. So like Pete has a MacBook Air with a 256 gig drive, and CrashPlant was saying that it was going to back up like 360 gigs. Like, well, that's not possible, but it is, because it was treating the way the version one of the transporter software works. It makes it appear like all this data is on your hard drive, even when it's not. And again, 2.0 will solve a lot of this. So unchecking that folder is important, but then also in library application support are two connected data folders that cache some of that stuff. So, you know, you could potentially back it up twice from the same computer, even if you didn't want to back it up at all. So yeah, downloads, Dropbox, connected data, Cloud Station, which is the private cloud thing that you get if you have a Synology NAS, which you'll be getting soon, John. I'm very excited about this. Mobile documents folder inside your library. That's the iCloud data. That's another one to skip, unless you feel like you need it. And mail downloads too is another one that you may or may not need, which is also in the library folder. So that's what I skip.
Well, and actually a general strategy to do that is to get something like Omni Disk Sweeper to identify the big chunks of data that you may not need to back up.
Yes, yeah. And there's an article, we talked about this in a show, but there's an article that Jim wrote up for us, and it shows you how to run Omni Disk Sweeper as root, because there are some things that you won't see just from running it from your user account. So you can go to the terminal and it's a very simple command to type. And in fact, you can copy and paste it from the article. So we'll put the article in the show notes. But yeah, that's good stuff. I always forget about Omnidisk Sweeper, even though it's one of my favorites. All right, moving on to Brad, Mr. Braun.
Where are you, Brad?
Hey, John and Dave, Brad over in Michigan. Hey, I wanted to pass this along to you guys, and hopefully maybe this is something that could help somebody else out there that's having a similar problem. I was getting an error message when I was syncing my iPad to iTunes, saying that one item failed to sync and to check iTunes for more information. Unfortunately, iTunes was not providing me with any more information. There were no errors or flags in iTunes stating, you know, what the failed sync was all about. So I did some Googling and found some solutions, but nothing seemed to help. And then it dawned on me that I had recently downloaded an update for Modern Combat 4. It was about a gig and a half. And I went into iTunes and I saw that it wasn't updating. And, you know, it was still indicating that it needed to update that app. Then I looked at my iPad and I noticed there was about 800 meg free on it. And I thought, well, why not? So I cleared up some more space in my iPad. In fact, I cleared up 1.5 gigs of space on my iPad. And voila, sure enough, the sync went through. It finally allowed the update to take place. And I was good to go. So a couple things I learned from this. Number one, I guess you have to have enough space on your iPad equal to the size of the update that needs to take place. And I would have assumed that the sync process would be smart enough to say, hey, I've got a gig and a half update for Modern Combat 4. Delete the one that's on there and put the new one on. Therefore, you don't have to free up more space in order just to do an update. Evidently, that's not the case. And the second thing I learned was, Apple, it would be nice if Apple were to display that type of information in iTunes if indeed this failure does occur. So, but anyways, I thought I'd pass this along. Thought it was a little bit interesting, and hopefully maybe it'll help somebody else out there who's seeing that message as well. All right, guys, we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks, Brad. Yeah, so I agree with you that Apple should give you better information about why it can't apply this update. But I do also understand why they don't do what you first suggested. Now, you could do that manually by deleting the app and all of its associated data, which is what happens when you delete an iOS app, and then reinstall from the App Store, and then that would give you the update. So that's possible, but you do lose all your data. When Apple puts an app out there, they don't want to delete your data. And so they put the app in a temporary spot, make sure all the data that's going to be there is successfully moved or downloaded and decompressed on your iPad or iPhone or iPod Touch. And then they move it into place. So it's a protective thing, because if it fails halfway through, then you're left with nothing on your iPad, and that's bad. So that's why they do it that way. And some developers include default preferences files and things like that that should or shouldn't get replaced depending on whether you have data out there. So there's more to it than just put the application there, because sometimes part of the sandbox comes with it. So that's why. But I agree, the error messages should be better. Thanks for the tip, man. It's good.
And I'm giving you another tip, Dave.
Go.
I'm going to put this in our room, and of course we'll have it in the notes here.
Oh, well, say hi to the chat room. Everybody at MacGeekUp.com/stream. Thanks for being here with us, and thanks for helping out with the show notes. You guys are awesome.
So I posted a link here. There's a Apple has an article called iTunes Specific Update and Restore Error Messages in Advanced Troubleshooting. And what they do is they basically have a list of all the useless error code numbers, which you can then translate to English if you know about this article. I hate programs that use numeric error messages.
Well, it's easier than localizing them.
Right. It's actually worth mentioning. So that's one. And then there's another general one that I think is buried deep within the OS here. But if you go to the terminal, you say Mac error, I think it is.
Yeah, only this is only for the Mac, not for iOS, though.
Okay, but there's a thing if you go to the terminal and you type Mac error, a space, and then the error number from whatever program is generating this, and this is more OS level errors. So probably mostly from the Finder, but you never know. But basically, it'll tell you what the number means. So between those two resources, you can decipher what the error really is.
As long as Apple gives you a numeric error.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I don't think they did for Brad, right? I think it just, you know, general, this failed. Sorry, dude. Mm-hmm. But you might be able to find it in the console logs. That's the other place to look. If you want, you know, Apple does go out of their way to make the user experience what they deem in their minds to be smooth. And that may be different from what, you know, us geeks or budding geeks would want, which is more data. But they do store more data often. They just don't push it to the users. So go ahead and check out the console when you're getting this, and you might get a whole lot more data, and you might get one of these error codes and maybe even get a description of the error. But you know, you certainly might get one of these error codes that you could then go look up. Good stuff. Want to take us to Brent, John?
Or, I mean, absolutely. Yeah. There's what Brent says. So I have a fifth generation Ape. Oh, airport. I don't know if he means
extreme
or express.
He means extreme.
I wouldn't mind having an Ape, but well, no, that could be a, yeah, that could be a maintenance nightmare. Okay. Not the brand new one, last year's model. I use OpenDNS. I have my iMac connected via Ethernet. All right. And as you can see by the airport utility screenshot, it is showing my DNS as OpenDNS addresses. And that, yeah, with the latest airport utility, if you hover over it, it'll give you some pieces of information, the DNS that it sees being one of them. However, when I use the iOS airport utility, it is showing the DNS as the same as the router. See the other screenshots. In this case, we see, I think, what normally the NAT address that is assigned to the device. And to me, that's perfectly normal. Then he says, we have two iPhones and one iPad who can really no longer connect. Either it takes forever to connect to my network and it might work for a minute, but then it either disconnects or stays connected, but sites won't load, etc. I am running Mountain Lion server, though I do have DNS turned off. I tried entering either OpenDNS or Google DNS addresses manually into the iOS devices, but no luck. I did power cycle the airport, but that didn't seem to help. And I didn't cycle the modem, but like I said, the iMac has no issues. Help! All right.
Well, I'm going to start, John, by saying I don't think this has to do with the... I don't think the OpenDNS or whatever the DNS settings are on the router are the problem. Because, right? Because he tried manually entering them on the iOS client and it still didn't get through. So that, I mean, that would totally bypass whatever the router's saying. And it still doesn't work.
Right.
Right?
It could be. But I offer something that could help determine.
Go.
That,
yeah.
Or narrow it down. So a few things to try here. So one, I'm thinking it may be some sort of weird DNS caching issue. And the best I could find, Dave, so you can, I'm not sure if you can explicitly reset the DNS caching, but the closest thing I found, at least on the iOS side, is that you can, if you go into settings and general, there'll be a reset category, and there's something reset network settings, which as far as I can tell, clears out a lot of stuff. You may have to punch in some numbers again, but that's the closest thing I found to a reset, short of doing a full device reset, which I don't think is necessary. So maybe do reset network settings and see if that helps.
On the iOS device.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, he says that his iMac is connected Ethernet, and obviously his iOS devices are connected Wi-Fi. Chris Humphreys in the chat room suggests that this might be related to a bug in the current firmware. Marco Arment posted an article about a month ago detailing that he had some of these problems, and he downgraded from 7.6.3 firmware on his Airport Extreme to 7.6.1, and that solved the problem for him. almost exactly these symptoms, because it's not a DNS issue. It's just a connectivity issue. I mean, we're trying 6 different DNS servers and all of them are failing. So what else is going on? I think your reset network settings is also a great troubleshooting tip, because this happens sometimes where your iOS device gets tied in knots. I find sometimes with mine, I just toggle airport mode on for about 5 seconds and then turn it off. And that sometimes is enough to kind of just, say, okay, let's start this over, for that particular connection. And that can really help. But it could be a bug in the APE.
Now, I'm wondering the other thing that was offered is a good suggestion. Now, I don't know if this feature is in the latest airport software. Because I'm looking here, I seem to recall it being in the older airport software, is that you could actually say, oh, by the way, could you roll back to this version of firmware?
Mm-hmm.
In that the airport, or at least when I've worked with them, will typically store older versions, I guess, in a file somewhere. On the device, and you can always roll back to it.
That's what Marco's showing in the article.
Yeah. What I do find interesting, actually, when I run my airport here, so it shows mine, which is definitely an older generation, and version 763. If I click on that, it gives me another number. 76300.7. That's cute.
Okay.
Secret little. That's probably like the sub.
Yeah, the
version of the firmware in that
build
thing.
Number or yeah, something. Yep.
I don't see an option to restore older firmware, though.
You Moving have to hold. On, wait. No, there is. I mean, again, this is in Marco's article. If you hold down the option key, it becomes a drop down menu when you're hovering over the version.
Ah, sweet.
Yep. And does that give you the option?
Oh, look at that. Yes. I hold it down and I see a pull down and it says 763, 761, 76, 752 or other.
Yep. So dropping back to 761 has fixed this for many. So.
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe that'll fix it for Brent too.
Yeah. Now some of the other things that I suggested here. So if it is a DNS issue, a couple other things you could try in your troubleshooting is try to access something directly via IP address.
Yeah.
And if that works, but DNS doesn't, then that would confirm a DNS issue.
That's very true. Yeah, that's right.
So, and then actually, I thought I'd throw it in here, even though it doesn't apply in this case, but if you ever need to, so on the iOS side, I think that reset thing may clear out some cruft and caches and all that, but on the OS X side, there's actually an article that Apple offers that basically tells you how to reset the OS X DNS cache. And we'll link to that for those who need to clean out their caches.
Awesome. All right. While we're in the iOS realm, time to hear Craig's little tip, shall we?
Surely.
Hello, Dave and John. Just thought I'd like to point out something, maybe a kind of a cool thing found that maybe you guys weren't aware of. I certainly wasn't, and a lot of people on the web weren't either. Let's just say you want to grab an SD card that's full of photos and just shove them onto your iPad to look at them on a nice big screen. So you get your little SD card to lightning adapter, plug it in, and suck them in, and you can look at them all day and have a great time. Now, if you've only got 4 or 5 of them, when you do want to delete them, you just simply tap on them and delete them separately. That's fine, but if you have, like, say, 1,000 or 1,500, you're going to find that your finger's going to get worn out deleting them, and that's, near as I can tell, the only way to delete them individually. There's no way to select them all, and you're kind of done. That's what you've got to do. I did that once. It took me 20 minutes to delete 805 photos, and I didn't really want to have to do that again, so I went to the Apple store and asked around. The first guy I talked to said, yeah, that's it, you're stuck. But he said, but let me go check with this other guy. So he did, came back, and he said, there is a way to do it. You can connect your computer. By the way, if you connect to the computer and run iPhoto, you still can't delete them. They're not there. But you can if you select image capture. And plug it in and select image capture. There they all are. And of course, you can use the nice Mac ways of selecting as many as you want at a time, all of them, command select, shift select, anything you want, and delete them in large bunches. It does work really well. However, it still doesn't solve the problem of what if you don't have your computer around. Anyway, thought I'd point it out to you. Might help some people along the way.
Well, thanks, Craig. That's awesome. That's I always forget that image capture is there on the Mac. That's good stuff.
What's there? Oh, image capture. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it does a lot of things. I think it'll also, I haven't used it for a while, but I think it also provides interface to image scanners.
It can. That's right. Yep.
If they're standards compliant, I think if they're Twain, is it Twain or I? Yeah. But I remember using it. It'll, yeah. It's one of those hidden things you don't really think about.
It's a very lightweight app. I've used it when we've processed pictures during, keynotes and things like that, where we need to just slurp pictures into the Mac and do something with them quickly. You know, iPhoto is very pedantic about the way it pulls in pictures and indexes and, you know, all this stuff. Whereas image capture just slurps the images into a folder and that's it. So if that's all you need to do, or you need to do something quickly, it's great. It works, but like I said, very lightweight. So, you know, John, I did run. It's funny. You mentioned OmniDiskSweeper. I ran it and I found that, my sync services folder on my Mac was over 2 gigs mm-hmm. in size. Yeah. And,
I thought they're not using that anymore.
Well, that's what I thought too. And I'm like, what the heck, man? Why is this so big? But I also know that messing with the sync services folder is warned against, akin to messing with a swarm of bees. And there's actually a knowledge base article that says that has that phrase in it, as if it were a swarm of bees, stay away. So I figured, well, maybe there's another knowledge base article that tells me what I'm supposed to do. And sure enough, there is. In Lion and Snow Leopard, you can use the little sync wheel in the menu bar if you have it and reset sync services. But like you said, John, in theory, ostensibly, they're not using this anymore. And so that sync menu is gone in Mountain Lion. But there is a very straightforward terminal command that you can run, and it's buried in a system library frameworks folder. But the command is reset sync. And so you issue this command reset sync full, and then it cleared it out and cleared out, you know, nearly 2 gigs of data for me. So it, you know, even if you were using sync services, resetting this folder does not, all it does is effectively clear some caches. It doesn't delete data that, that any of your apps are using. It's just when sync services was in use, and I'm not convinced it's not, but when it's in use, what happens is you've got the data in your app on your Mac, and then presumably the data in the cloud, but that your app didn't talk directly to the cloud. Your app talked to the OS and the OS talked to the cloud. And so the OS had to maintain this, this cache so that all this data could be pushed back and forth in the right directions. And that's what this folder effectively, that's what this folder does. So it would not hurt, in my estimation, to clean out that folder. Having backups is always good. And backups kind of give me the freedom to experiment more than I might if I didn't have backups. But with this one, you know, running that command, it saved me 2 gigs. So I figured I'd share that little tip, and we'll put that particular link in the show notes as well, because that's how we roll here. Last week, John, we were talking about your cable modem issues, and we talked about pingtest.net and speedtest.net. And as you know, as some of you know, the folks in the chat room help us build the show notes. And Brian Monroe in the chat room snuck something into the show notes that astute listeners might have seen last week, but we didn't mention it in the show, so I want to mention it here. And it is a service called testmy.net. It's yet another speed test, but A, it doesn't require flash, which B means it runs on your iPad in the browser, just like it would on your Mac. And it does some cool tests, but it also shows you how you compare to others on your same provider. So you get a feel for, okay, do I have a real problem here, or is my provider just lame and slow? So check it out. Testmy.net. I figured I'd throw that in there too while we were on tip mode, John.
Well, I'll try another one.
Yeah, go.
Well, I was doing this when I was doing my packet loss test. So there is another one that you may have used, Dave. It's now Megapath. Speakeasy.
Yep.
Speakeasy.net.
Yep.
And I think they're under a company called Megapath. But anyways, they have an enhanced one that shows you not only, so it kind of combines what some of the other services do in two separate products, is that it'll show you download speed, upload speed, packet loss, ping, and jitter.
Cool.
All on one screen.
Cool. Let's put a link for that in the show notes too. Yeah. That's awesome.
There we go.
Awesome.
Speed Test Plus.
Very nice. Megapath. Cool. All right. While we are on the follow-up subject, let's let Wally ask a question.
John, Dave, just listening to 455 and the discussion of Tor, anonymization, etc. on the network. Here's a question for you. Suppose I'm on a corporate network that is forbidden BitTorrent use, and I fire up one of these utilities to anonymize my traffic. What does my machine look like on the local subnet to people who are monitoring for activities of that sort? It seems to me that they'd still would spot me, but I'm just curious.
All right. That's a good question. In fact, it's a great question. If it were to work, they would not be able to tell that you were doing BitTorrent. However, and there's a very sparse answer about this on the Tails website, which again we will put into the show notes, that effectively says it won't work. And the reason is that they've intentionally made it so that it won't work. And of course there's a reason for that too. In short, you know, the path through the Tor network can and does change, which makes things like BitTorrent really painful, both because of speed, right? Because you're trying to get data from one person to another, and it's going through all these weird hops and bouncing all around. But this constant rerouting, you know, BitTorrent is a peer-to-peer protocol, and when it works the best is when you are directly talking to this other host. So by having it bounce around, not only does it make it painful for you and potentially the person sending it to you if they're aware of, you know, what they're doing, but it also makes it really painful for all of the hops in the middle by wasting all of this traffic with the constant rerouting and everything. So that's sort of at the core of why Tor and Tails effectively block this kind of stuff. Another path, though, to use BitTorrent is to connect to a VPN from your work, connect to a VPN, and then BitTorrent across that. And the VPN could be something at your home that you set up on your own via your router, or, you know, you can set up VPNs in your router if your router's software will do it, and that DDWRT software I mentioned earlier will. You can do it if you have an OS X server on your local network, and you can also do it, as John will find out when he gets his new disk station, there is a VPN package for the disk station that makes that really easy too. So kind of pick your poison, whatever hardware makes sense for you, and you can set up your own VPN. And then what happens is you tunnel into your home, and then the BitTorrent traffic kind of happens across that tunnel via your home. If you don't want to do that, there are many third-party services out there that will provide you a VPN. However, and I make no judgments here, but I want to make it clear, BitTorrent can be used for a lot of things. Some of them, many of them, are actually quite legal. You could be using BitTorrent Sync. You could be downloading concerts from, you know, archive.org or whatever in ways that are permitted by the artists, or you could use it for illegal downloads of movies and television shows, right? I don't know what you're using it for, but if you were to be using it for these illegal purposes, be careful when going through a VPN, because the VPN operator becomes the targeted party if the MPAA or, you know, the RIAA wants to reach out and say, hey, you're downloading something illegal. And they do suss this stuff out. And because of that, many VPN services monitor for BitTorrent activity across the board to be proactive about it and stop you before they get targeted. Because if they get targeted, then they lose their bandwidth providers, and that's bad for business. So if you are going to be doing legal BitTorrenting across a VPN, you might want to tell them, in fact, more than might, you definitely want to tell them ahead of time, here's my intentions, here's what I plan to do. It's not going to be illegal, but I just want you to know so that when you see this BitTorrent activity, you don't just shut me down, you know, with a sort of your blanket policy. And they may tell you, well, you need to find another VPN, and that's fine. But just be aware that if you are going to use it for a completely above board purposes, many VPNs may block you anyway. So perhaps that helps. But that would a VPN would hide it from your work network, as long as your work network allows you to VPN out, and some of them don't. So, you know.
Now,
go.
To add to this.
Yes, please.
So if you want to use, so this is specifically about Tor. So I actually found a little ditty here on the Tor site or an FAQ, and this is a good question. I think it applies to this. My firewall only allows a few outgoing ports is the statement here. And they basically say if your firewall works by blocking ports, then you can tell Tor to only use the ports that your firewall permits by adding fascist firewall space one to your Tor configuration file, or by clicking my firewall only lets me connect to certain ports in Vidalia's network settings window. And basically what that does, I'll read the rest of it here, but it's pretty straightforward. That basically tells it, okay, please only use ports 80 and 443. Normally, I think Tor and BitTorrent work best when they have free reign over the ports to use, but as pointed out a lot of times, that's not possible. So in this case, this does what a lot of other programs do, is almost every installation is going to allow traffic on port 80, which is HTTP, and 443, which is secure HTTP. So routing your traffic through commonly used ports may make it less obvious that you're using a product like this.
Right. But still wouldn't work. It still wouldn't work for BitTorrent just because Tor doesn't work for BitTorrent. But yes, otherwise. Yeah. But yes. And there's also things called, I saw this when we were researching it for last week. Tor bridges, I think is the right term, where you can connect to something else that then connects to the Tor network, and the bridges are specifically not published. You'd have to, I think, you got to look this up. We'll put a link somewhere, but I think you send an email to like bridges at, I don't know, something tor.org, but it's not. But you send an email and then you'll get an email back with the list of current bridges, and you can put those in, and they change regularly enough that, network administrators don't specifically know that they're Tor bridges. And so if they're blocking Tor specifically, you might be able to bounce around it that way. I don't know. I didn't dig too deep into that, so I can't really tell you, but there you go. We'll find something out there about Tor bridges. All right. Joe has it's always an important question. He says, recently I went with a friend to Foxwoods Casino down in Connecticut, not too far from you, John. He says, I used Apple Maps and discovered that the casino was about 10 miles from the location shown on the map. How can I get Apple to correct its map app for this item? There is a mechanism inside of Apple's maps that lets you do exactly this. When you're inside the map, you pull up the location and, you know, you hit your little dot and pull up info on the location. And down at the bottom is a report a problem button. And in that, you can say information is correct, pins at the wrong location, place doesn't exist, or my problem isn't listed. and then you can add more information on the next place. So you can correct maps. So if you find a problem, please do correct it for the rest of us. And we promise to do the same. And when I say we promise, I mean all of us, everybody listening here, we're all committed to helping one another. So it's what we do. You ever been to Foxwoods with Apple's Maps and gotten off by 10 miles, John?
Machines are trying to kill us.
Oh, dude.
Skynet.
Yeah.
I've been watching some Terminator lately. So, yeah, Skynet comes up. But that's pretty poor. I haven't used Apple Maps for driving. I've used it for walking directions, and it's good for that. Like bopping around Manhattan to get my bearings sometimes. I find it really good for that.
I've used it for driving. It's been fantastic when traveling because the maps navigation on the iPhone is the best navigation you'll get because they get to do things that they don't let third parties do, like interacting with the lock screen and all of that cool stuff. I haven't had a problem with it, but I mean, obviously some people have. So, yeah.
I still use Waze.
I know. Yeah. Driving. Well, I just, you know, Apple's Maps just burns less battery, I guess is what it comes down to for me. And I don't need it all the time. Both of our cars have built-in GPSs. So the only time I use it is when I'm traveling and, you know, in a rental car or whatever. And at that point it's, you know, it's just right there. I don't even need to make sure I have the app installed. So, well, I don't know, but maybe I should use Waze. I mean, it's not that difficult for me to install the app. I could probably do it while we're talking here. And, everybody seems to love it. Brian Moreau in the chat room saying, dude, use Waze. Don't be an idiot. So maybe I'll use Waze for our trip up to Maine today. Cause, after we finish the show, John, my vacation for the week begins and we're heading up to Booth Bay Harbor. Spend some time with family.
Yeah. I don't know how much you're going to get out of that. I mean, it's kind of desolate up there
in Maine, in Booth Bay. Have you ever been there? It's awesome.
Just kidding.
I love it.
But part of the power of Waze, and it shows you this when you start it up, is it shows you how many nearby people are also connected to the Waze network. And that's what my favorite part is, that you can use Waze to stick it to the man.
Well, that now I'm signing up right now. What's how do you stick it to the man? Which man report, are we talking about?
Well, if you spot a traffic enforcement,
a Maine state trooper, you mean?
Yeah, you report that, and basically it alerts other people in the area.
Oh, that's sweet.
And likewise, yeah, if you're near an area where someone has reported it, then actually it'll come up and say, oh, I think that somebody reported a cop, you know, 500 feet ahead or something, and they're like, is he still there? And if you do it, then actually it gives the person who reported it says, oh, so-and-so, thank you for your report. Otherwise, if enough people don't acknowledge it, then it assumes that they go away and it pulls it off the map.
That's really smart. All right. So I am installing it literally as we speak here. So I will have it burning my battery the whole way to Maine, I'm sure. We do have to stop at the Apple store. No, my daughter's iPhone 5 has basically ever since she got it, I think, has had wacky battery issues. And so we totally wiped the iPhone and did not restore from a backup because we know that that's the first thing the Apple store, the Genius Bar, is going to tell us to do. So we did it anyway, proactively. And it's weird. Her battery will get down to like 20% and then the phone shuts off. But then she can turn it back on and it reports that it's at, you know, 30%. Then it gets down to 15 and the phone shuts off. There's something. It ain't right, man. It ain't right.
Actually had fun at one point. I don't know what they think is going on, but sometimes I would run on the train to see how fast we were moving because it can display your speed.
Yeah.
But it's funny, but I don't know exactly what it thought was happening, because the thing is, a lot of times the train is parallel to the highway in a lot of areas.
Sure.
So what it made it appear was that I'm driving at 70 miles an hour on a highway that, as far as it's concerned, people are sitting there doing nothing. So I'm just wondering what they're... main computer thinks. It's like, okay, how is this guy going 70 miles an hour through standstill traffic?
that's a good trick. That's a good trick. You know, while we're on this subject here, John, and I don't even know how much time we have left. Yeah, it's probably a good one to wrap up with. Maybe we'll see. But anyway, relevant question from David.
Hey, John and Dave, this is David from Raleigh, North Carolina, with a question regarding iPads Wi-Fi only versus a 3G or 4G model now, I guess. What I want to do is use it in my car or as a GPS device, and I understand the Wi-Fi only model doesn't have a GPS chip in it, so you got to get the 4G iPad mini, preferably. And what I don't know is in terms of a service plan, if I need to get one where I could just tether it to my iPhone and then therefore it'll render the GPS data and then pull in the points of interest, et cetera, stuff via the tethering connection to my iPhone for like the Apple's Maps app, or if I need to get a true data plan just for the iPad to be able to render that stuff. I did a little Google foo and kind of inconclusive in what I was reading if a tethering option would work to pull in that stuff into Maps information. So if you could let me know your thoughts on that, and that would certainly help in my purchase decision. This is where you cut me off.
And cut we off, you shall. Wait, cut you off, we shall. Oh, we'll do it right. Yeah, so I've actually done this because I have a 3G or LTE iPad. I have a full-size one. I'd like to get the mini. I really should get the mini. But anyway, so there's two things, as you astutely pointed out, David. Number one is that the Wi-Fi model does not have its own GPS chip, but the LTE or 3G or 4G version does. You do not, in my experience, you do not need to have an active data plan in order for the GPS chip to work. It's just a hardware thing that's part of the more enhanced, technologically enhanced iPads. So yes, you can tether, but you need to make sure that you go into settings and turn on cellular data. Honestly, I haven't checked it the other way, but I've always done this. I've turned on cellular data. Then it comes up and says, you don't have a plan. You just hit cancel. But perhaps you don't even need to do that. Maybe the GPS chip is live, but I've always had it on, but not paying for a plan, and then just tether it Wi-Fi, or actually a better way to tether it to your iPhone is Bluetooth. It works just as smoothly, in fact, more smoothly, and saves more battery in my experience for both devices. So yeah, you can get your data across another channel while still using the GPS. So there you go. That's my feeling on it, John.
Now, my observation is that actually location services can work with a Wi-Fi only device.
Yeah, but it doesn't have GPS. And
I understand.
For driving, but you're totally right. Yes, it can use Wi-Fi for location services, Wi-Fi triangulation or whatever.
Because I did this once, actually. I was experimenting. And if you're in an area with enough Wi-Fi, it may work well enough. But I actually did this one time with the Strava application. They have two apps, one for walking and one for biking, and that'll record your bike route. And I'm like, you know what? Let me run the program with my iPod Touch and see what happens. And it actually worked pretty well, except there was one area that was kind of a dead zone. And so it showed me jumping from like one street, like through a marsh, to another street, but it actually mapped my route pretty accurately using just Wi-Fi on an iPod Touch. I was actually pretty impressed.
Plus, you get to prove to people that you did some sweet jumps on your bike.
Well, that's what it looked like because it recorded the route, and I'm like, yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. So I don't think in a car moving at those speeds, especially on highways where there's not a whole lot of Wi-Fi signals. Consistently, I don't think it's going to work out, but through a neighborhood. Yeah. In fact, I had forgotten about that. Lucas and I went out for a bike ride not that long ago, and we used Strava, and I put it on my iPhone, which of course has GPS, and he used his iPod Touch, and we saw the same thing. It basically worked, you know, through a neighborhood. Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, John, I think unless you have anything in particular that you want to share with our esteemed listeners, I think it's time to bring the band in and move on to the next phase of our days and weeks here. Because I have an appointment at the Apple Store on the way to Maine with Skyler's iPhone. So it's we got stuff to do. Plus, I'm not packed yet entirely. That's not
Maine.
Yeah.
Gotta have some lobsters.
Yeah, we will. We will. You know, we're not that far from Maine. I mean, I'm 10 minutes from Maine, so we wind up getting lobster all summer anyway, but it is more fun to eat it in Maine. The best is... So I've got a bunch of extended family that all basically live within walking distance of each other up there. They've sort of retired, and this is their thing. But several of them, in fact, all of them live really close to the water. So we can do lobster bakes, and the best way to do it is to go down to the water and boil the lobsters in seawater. So we go down, and it's, I mean, it's heavy bringing back a big, you know, pot full of seawater from the ocean. But, man, it's the right way to cook them. So that's what we do. That's what they say. And then the crazy lobstermen tell you that you should put the lobsters in the cold water and slowly heat it up. Let them be in there while the water comes to a rolling boil. They say it's more tender that way, but that's crazy. Hmm. They might be right.
I usually steam them.
No. We boil them we do the little ones, the little chick lobsters. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right, what else do we have? Anything else?
No, next week I'll do a brain dump on all the cool stuff I found.
Yeah, so we'll do cool stuff found next week. Yeah, and the cool stuff you found. So send in your stuff. John will be on point all week, processing it all. We'll have a list of about 150 things to go through, as we always do. And then we'll do that, I think, this time next Sunday morning. We'll meet at about 9:30, 9:45 Eastern Daylight Time. Yeah, so John, why do you say, oh man?
It's early.
That's a good time for us. I'm going to be getting back late the night before, I think.
Nah, I'm woken up by then.
Yeah.
I still got to talk to my neighbor about firing up the mower at 7 in the morning. It's a little too early for me.
That's probably against your town code, too.
I actually looked up our noise ordinance. So actually, quiet hours end at 7 a.m. during the week and 8 a.m. on the weekend. And I believe they begin at 11 p.m.
Okay.
So he's technically within the law, but it's like, dude, do you have to start mowing the lawn at 7 in the morning?
I have a question for you.
Wait.
I have a question for you, John. Does your neighbor have small kids?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and you can have noise until 11 p.m., correct?
Correct.
All right, so let me bring one of my bands down there, and we'll set up on your deck, and we'll start the set at, you know, reasonable hour, maybe 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and we'll play right through until we're supposed to stop at 11. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Yeah. That'll fix his wagon.
He had a gathering there the other day and invited me over, so no, he's cool.
No, I know. It's better to solve these things, you know, by talking as opposed to... Although sometimes the nonverbal communication of music...
Oh, yeah, no, next time I see him, I'm like, I'd just be like, dude, crack of dawn is... to me, it's not a very pleasant alarm clock. Even my alarm clock makes a relatively more pleasant noise than a mower at 7 in the morning.
Yeah. We're gonna have to fire our lawn guys here. We're going to start doing our lawn ourselves again. It's getting crazy.
I got a push mower, too, which actually I use for quick jobs.
Like a non-powered, just a...
just a blade.
Just a blade, yeah.
Just a rotating blade.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
They still sell them.
Oh, yeah. And one of my neighbors uses one to mow his lawn. He has a lot of time on his hands, but, you know.
Yeah, because my other one now, another thing that needs to be fixed. So now the car's working, but yeah, my mower has some problem with the fuel because I'll start it, it'll run for a while, and then it just dies. No reason.
Oh, it's your car.
All right.
Carburetor's getting flooded.
Yeah, but I keep a... And actually, to get it to work now, I have to spray carb cleaner in there to get it to start. So,
Dude, anytime I'm in a situation where I need to tell a story that's like a manly story, I talk about the time where I rebuilt the carb on my mower. It was pretty awesome, actually.
Well, I'll do that because actually I have a backup mower. One where which is essentially the same engine, so I think I'll swap out the carb.
No, you can fix it. You just got to take it out and take it all apart and clean it. You'll get gasoline all over your hands. I mean, you will stink like gas. I think I still stink like gasoline. And this happened long before our first child was born, probably about 15, 16 years ago. I still stink like gasoline. But you take it apart. The hardest part is getting it back together because there's like little, it's small. And there's little springs and things that need to be.
It looks complicated. Yeah,
but it's fun.
All right.
It's a fun thing to do. What else are you going to do? You got the whole afternoon ahead of you. That's right. All right, so if you want to send in cool stuff found or questions or tips, John, what email address should we have them use?
One that you could use is feedback@mackiegab.com.
Did you say feedback@mackiegab.com, John?
Last I checked, Dave, it is still feedback@mackiegab.com.
And you can send, of course, text, email, you can send screenshots, you can send audio, you can send video, you can send whatever you want. If you want to send audio and you want to make your life a little bit easier, you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335.
And if you want to make it even easier than that, thank you for the translation, John. If you want to make it even easier than that, go and get the Mac Geekab app in the App Store. And that will send an email directly to us. You can record it right inside the app. And if you're listening to a show while you're, while you're inspired to send us something, it will actually tag your email with not only the episode, but the chapter and the timestamp for us. So we know what your point is in reference to. So very handy. And we hope you enjoy the app. The app also allows you to join the chat room. You can do it directly from the app, and we have many people do that and can stream right there and even, stream when we're doing it live and chat with everybody else in the room. And we'll send you a push notification when that's happening, too. So check it all out. Mac Geekab app, of course, in the iOS, the iTunes App Store.
And
yes,
you can reach us on Facebook.com/MacGeekab, where you will see a notification of when the next show is going to happen, when the show notes are posted, and other interesting trivia that has to do with the show. And the Twitters. I use that every now and then. The show is Mac Geekab. I am John Efron. He is David Hamilton. That other guy is Pilot Pete. And the publication is Mac Observer, all on Twitter.com.
That's right. And I've got my Instagram synced with Twitter. So when I post things to Instagram, pictures of lobster this week, you can follow along with that. But sometimes I also post Mac relevant stuff, too. Yeah, that'll do it. So we want to, but it won't quite do it. We want to thank Michael Johnston, John, because he is the one who converts this show to AAC, technically, we convert it to AAC and send it to him, but that's the easy work. The hard work is going through and adding links, chapters, and pictures, and that's what Michael does. He enhances the show. So, and he has been doing it for us for, gosh, almost 8 years. I mean, I think it started in September, maybe, of the first year we were doing the show, I think. So we're coming up on Michael doing this with us for 8 years, too. But anyway, we'd like to thank you, Michael, for doing that. Michael is also the host of the We Have Communicators podcast and the publisher of GetAppLure.com. So check all that out, too. Of course, Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, provides all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you. And so we'd like to thank them for doing that with us, too. The podcast marketplace, John, includes BB Edit from Barebone Software, Gazelle.com to sell all your Apple stuff, Text Expander, PDF, Pen, Disk Label, all from SmileSoftware.com, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. So, John, I'm gonna take some advice. I actually just read it in the chat room. And it was, I believe it was Grumpy in the chat room says, he wants to share some advice for the lobsters, this week in Maine. And that advice is